Okay, so you guys have really sent us some fascinating stuff to dig into this time, a whole lecture, actually. It's all about medieval Catholicism. And, well, today we're going to cut right to the core, you know, like, what were the big theological ideas driving the medieval Roman Catholic Church? Because to really get what came after, we got to grasp this world first.
Exactly. Yeah. Think of it as laying the foundation. And you know what you've sent over, it's actually from a lecture series by Dr. Roger Green called The Reformation to the Present. This is specifically session two, and we're going to be zeroing in on, well, on the theological landscape of the church right before the Reformation kicked off, before, you know, Luther and Calvin and all those guys came along and shook things up. And it's interesting to note that this was a church already wrestling with, well, with its own internal issues and questions and complexities, really.
Okay. So let's jump in. Dr. Green, he starts his lecture by laying out some major things to consider if you're going to study theology. And I got to say, these really resonated with me. Like, these are things I think you, our listener, you're looking for when you dive deep into this kind of material with us. His first point is about, he calls it majoring in the majors, which is all about, you know, focusing on the key ideas, the turning points, the big names, and not getting stuck in the weeds of, you know, all the little details.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's about figuring out what's really crucial to understanding the big picture. And that's exactly what we're aiming for here, right? Like, giving you those high impact insights without getting lost in the deep theological jargon.
Absolutely. It's about smart learning, right? You know, equipping you with the most important pieces of knowledge so that you can like understand the underlying structure. And Dr. Green also emphasizes how important it is to approach theology with humility and reverence. He uses the example of Saint Augustine. I mean, this is a giant in Christian thought, right? But even Augustine, you know, he asked forgiveness for any errors in his work on the Trinity, which I think is a powerful reminder that these are profound subjects, and we engage with them as well as fellow seekers of understanding.
That's a good grounding principle to have, that
Purple,
humility.
yeah.
And then Dr. Green, he goes on to really emphasize just how central theology has been to the very life of the church. He argues that you just can't understand the church's actions, its motivations, its history, like any of it, without getting the theological engine driving it all. He even gives this incredibly powerful example of Maximus the Confessor. You know, this guy, he had his tongue and his hand cut off for defending his theological beliefs against the emperor. It really brings home how deeply people felt about these ideas.
It's a stark reminder that theology wasn't just some, you know, some abstract intellectual game. People were willing to endure, I mean, serious suffering for what they believed to be true. And Dr. Green, he also touches on this dynamic, this relationship between history and theology, which is a really interesting point, I think. You know, history raises questions, right? Like, think about societal changes or philosophical shifts. And then theology comes in and tries to offer answers based on scripture and the development of church doctrine. But then those answers, they can shape the course of history. So it's like this continuous feedback loop.
It's so true.
Like, think about, you know, different theological understandings of the Eucharist, for example, that led to huge historical and even political divides,
Oh
right?
yeah, for sure.
So yeah, it's all connected.
Like theology, it's like it provides this framework through which people see their world and act within it.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
And speaking of interpretation, Dr. Green, he makes it clear that theology, it's not about like trying to erase mystery. It's more about using our intellect, the gifts we've been given, you know, to explore our faith and understand it as fully as we can, while recognizing that there will always be some things that, well, they remain beyond our grasp. He mentions the Trinity, Christology, justification by faith. These are like the big ones, prime examples of this dance between reason and mystery.
It's reassuring, I think, to know that intellectual exploration and a sense of awe, they're not mutually exclusive.
Okay, so that's a good point for anyone kind of engaging with theological study. It's not about finding like these neat, simplistic answers to everything. It's about wrestling with, you know, with huge questions and doing that with both our minds and sense of reverence.
And finally, Dr. Green, he expresses this hope that, well, that this exploration will resonate with you, the listener, on a personal level, mm-hmm. that you'll take these concepts and think about how they might inform your own understanding and your life. He's encouraging this dupper, more applied engagement with these ideas. It's not just about, you know, academic interest.
Totally, yeah. And just to reiterate, for clarity's sake, as Dr. Green emphasizes, our focus in this deep dive, it's on the medieval Roman Catholic Church, specifically the era leading up to the Reformation.
Right.
So we're not talking about like present day Catholicism.
Right.
It's more about trying to understand the theological landscape that figures like Luther and others, they emerged from.
Yeah.
A landscape that, as Dr. Green points out, was already facing, well, its own internal tensions and challenges.
Exactly. Okay. So with that crucial context in place, let's really dive into the heart of medieval Catholic theology. And I think a great place to start is with their understanding of sin. Because as Dr. Green highlights, their way of dividing sin into these categories of mortal and venial sin, it was absolutely fundamental to their entire doctrine of justification.
Okay, so lay it out for us. What made a sin mortal in the medieval Catholic view? Like, what made it so, so serious?
Well, in medieval Catholic theology, they defined mortal sin as a grave offense against God's law. You know, like think of it as a serious violation, like breaking one of the Ten Commandments with full knowledge and consent. And the term mortal, it carried a huge weight because, you know, it was believed that this type of sin, it actually killed the spiritual life of the soul. Mm-hmm. You know, like it severed its relationship with God and led to eternal punishment. That's the bad news Dr. Green refers to. But there was a way back.
Okay.
Mortal sins could be confessed to a priest, and through the sacrament of penance, they could be absolved. And this absolution, it would restore the soul's relationship with God and prevent that eternal damnation. But crucially, it didn't wipe away the temporal punishment due for that sin.
Oh, okay. So you could be forgiven the eternal consequences, but there was still a debt to be paid, so to speak.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, what about venial sin? How is that different from these like soul-killing offenses?
So venial sins, those were considered, well, less serious offenses. Small, pardonable transgressions against God or your neighbor. Technically, they weren't thought to, like, sever the soul's relationship with God or lead to eternal punishment.
Right.
Dr. Green uses this very relatable example. He talks about accidentally making a mistake, adding numbers.
Okay.
It's an error, right? It's not intended to cause any significant harm or disrespect.
Right.
But yeah. Even venial sins, they carried temporal penalties, meaning that some form of a, you know, purification or satisfaction was still required. The key difference, as Dr. Green points out, often came down to the intention and the gravity of the action. So like if a merchant intentionally overcharged a customer, that would probably be seen as a mortal sin.
Okay.
Because it involves, you know, deliberate dishonesty and harm.
That distinction makes sense on paper.
Mm-hmm.
But Dr. Green touches on this very practical and I imagine anxiety-inducing challenge for the average person living in the medieval world. How were they supposed to know consistently and accurately whether something they did was a quote-unquote, grave offense, deserving of eternal damnation, or a small and pardonable one.
Right, right. And that was a huge source of spiritual anxiety. Because for the laity, their understanding of sin and its severity was largely shaped by their local priest.
Right.
The problem was, there wasn't always this clear, universally defined and applied standard for what made a sin mortal or venial,
mm-hmm.
you know? So what one priest in one village might consider a venial slip-up, another priest in the next village over might see as a mortal sin requiring, like, serious penance.
Right.
And this ambiguity, it created this pervasive fear of unknowingly committing a sin that could have eternal consequences. Imagine living with that constantly.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And this underlying fear, Dr. Green suggests, it had a direct impact on the religious practices of the time.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, absolutely. Because given this uncertainty and the incredibly high stakes involved, you know, eternal salvation or damnation, the safest course of action for most people was frequent and very thorough confession.
Mm-hmm.
They would confess everything, all their sins, even the ones they were unsure about, you know, as a kind of spiritual insurance policy to make sure their souls were protected. Dr. Green uses the powerful example of Martin Luther, you know, in his early monastic life, confessing for hours each day, sometimes up to 6 hours. This really illustrates the deep fear of sin and the rigorous pursuit of absolution that characterized a lot of medieval Catholic culture. It wasn't always about, you know, this joyful and direct relationship with God. It was often about navigating this complex system of sin and its consequences through the church's prescribed channels.
Yeah, it really paints a vivid picture of the religious climate. Okay, so we have this framework of sin divided into these two categories and this huge emphasis on regular confession. What's the next key element in this theological system that Dr. Green unpacks for us?
So the next absolutely essential piece is the doctrine of purgatory.
Okay.
Dr. Green emphasizes just how central and important this belief was in the medieval worldview. You know, it was woven deeply into how they understood life after death.
So in this medieval context, what was purgatory? Like, how did they understand it?
Okay, so purgatory was understood as this intermediate state or place. It's where baptized believers went after death to undergo purification from the temporal punishment they had incurred because of the sins they committed after baptism.
Okay.
Right. So the belief was that while baptism, it washed away original sin and any sins committed before it, sins committed after baptism, they still required some kind of cleansing.
Got it.
Dr. Green mentions this kind of strategic, you could even say cynical example of Emperor Constantine, who delayed his baptism until he was literally on his deathbed.
Oh, wow.
In the hopes of getting a clean slate and a direct ticket to heaven. A strategy which, Dr. Green rightly points out, was pretty risky theologically.
Yeah, you'd think so.
But for most ordinary people who were baptized as infants and, you know, inevitably sinned throughout their lives, they believed there was this accumulation of temporal punishment that needed to be dealt with. So purgatory was that in-between realm distinct from hell, which was, you know, eternal separation from God. It's where this purging, this purification took place before someone could finally enter heaven and be in God's presence fully. Think of it as a spiritual waiting room for heaven, but one where this process of cleansing was actively happening.
So it wasn't like a second chance to avoid hell if you were unrepentant, but more like this final stage of paying off the remaining debt of sin for those already kind of destined for heaven.
Exactly. And Dr. Green points out that there were some notable exceptions to this general rule of going to purgatory.
Okay.
So, for instance, martyrs. Mm-hmm. They were believed to go straight to heaven because their sacrificial death served as their purgation.
Right.
Exemplary saints like Virgin Mary. They were thought to be assumed directly into heaven as well. And interestingly, Dr. Green points out that often higher clergy, including popes, they were also expected to bypass purgatory because of their, you know, supposedly holy lives and their service to the church.
I mean, it makes sense.
Which you can imagine often caused resentment and cynicism among, you know, the common people.
Yeah.
Who, you know, frequently witnessed less than saintly behavior among, you know, certain members of the clergy.
Of course.
So, yeah, it really shows how these theological beliefs, they really intersected with the social and political realities of the time.
Yeah, that social dimension is really fascinating. And Dr. Green mentions the doctrine of purgatory. It wasn't like solely based on explicit scriptural references in a way that later Protestant reformers would emphasize, right?
That's right. While it drew on certain interpretations of biblical texts that were accepted by the Catholic Church at the time, the most notable being 2 Maccabees 12:39-45, yeah, which discusses prayers for the dead. The doctrine of purgatory, it largely developed through church tradition and, you know, the teachings of influential theologians over centuries.
Okay.
Dr. Green emphasizes that a key assumption behind purgatory was this idea that while God, you know, he offers forgiveness for sin, his divine justice, it still demands some kind of punishment or satisfaction.
Right.
This is a critical point, I think, because the reformers later, they directly challenged this very understanding of God.
Yeah.
You know, like, is God primarily a God of retributive justice or a God of unconditional grace and forgiveness?
That's a huge question.
Yeah.
Okay. So that tension between like divine justice and divine grace,
yeah,
it seems to be a central point of disagreement.
Yeah.
So going back to purgatory, how did the average person in the Middle Ages actually imagine purgatory? Like, what were the popular beliefs about this place?
Well, Dr. Green outlines several key elements of the common person's understanding. So first, there is this really strong belief that their dead loved ones, their family, their friends, were probably suffering in purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
And the imagery of purgatory in popular piety and medieval art, it often involved, you know, fire and intense purging.
Oh, wow.
Conveying this sense of suffering and purification.
Yeah.
And then second, people generally believed that those being purified in purgatory, they were completely unable to help themselves. They were in this state of passive suffering and had no way to shorten their time there.
Oh, man.
And third, there was this prevailing sense that God himself wouldn't directly intervene to help them until his divine justice was completely satisfied.
So it paints a picture of a God who, at least in this in-between stage, seems kind of distant.
Yeah.
And bound by his own rules of justice.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really bleak and kind of helpless situation.
It does.
For those who were believed to be in purgatory, was there any hope? Was there any way for the living to, like, influence the fate of their loved ones?
Yes. And this is where the fourth element comes in. Over time, the belief developed that those still living, they could do certain things, prayers, good works, and crucially, purchasing indulgences.
Okay.
And all of this was believed to potentially shorten or even end the time their loved ones spent in purgatory.
Interesting.
This belief became this huge aspect of medieval religious practice.
I bet.
And directly led to the widespread practice of indulgences, which, as Dr. Green mentioned earlier, we'll explore more detail later.
We will.
Dr. Green stresses that this perceived ability to influence the fate of the dead in purgatory, it offered this crucial glimmer of hope. And it was a powerful motivator for certain, you know, religious behavior.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, so who was calling the shots when it came to this whole purgatory system? Like, who decided the rules, the lengths of stay, who could be released?
Well, the Pope. Dr. Green really highlights the central role of the papacy in all matters related to purgatory.
Okay.
It was believed that the Pope, as, you know, the vicar of Christ on earth, he had the authority to determine the length of these punishments, to decide how they could be shortened, and even, you know, in certain cases, to grant full release from purgatory.
Wow.
So this gave the papacy a tremendous amount of spiritual power and, you know, by extension, temporal power as well, extending its influence not only over the lives of people on earth, but also into the realm of the afterlife.
Right.
Dr. Green points out that this link between the papacy and purgatory, this power to shape destinies even after death, it was a very significant and eventually very contentious issue.
I can see why. Okay, so we've explored this understanding of sin and the doctrine of purgatory.
Mm-hmm.
What's the third essential piece of this medieval theological puzzle that Dr. Green gives us?
The third key element is the concept and practice of penance. Dr. Green explains it on two levels. First, as a formal sacrament within the medieval Roman Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
And second, as it was commonly understood by the average person.
Okay, so let's start with penance as a sacrament. What were the essential steps involved in this process?
Okay, so as a sacrament, penance in the medieval church, it had four main steps. First, there was, you know, the commission of the sin itself.
Right.
Then second, and this is crucial, there was the act of confession, where, you know, believers were expected to confess all their sins.
Both mortal and venial.
Yes, all of them, to an ordained priest. Third, following that confession, the priest would pronounce absolution, which meant, you know, offering God's forgiveness for those confessed sins.
Okay.
And fourth, as a necessary part of the sacrament, the priest would assign specific works of penance for the individual to perform in their earthly life as a way of making satisfaction for the temporal punishment due for their sins.
So it wasn't enough just to confess and receive forgiveness. There was still this requirement to undertake these assigned works as a way of, like, atoning or paying off that debt you incurred through sin.
Exactly. And Dr. Green highlights this critical aspect of the system. If someone failed to perform those assigned works of penance, that failure itself was often considered a mortal sin.
Oh, wow.
Thus requiring further confession and even more penance. It was a cyclical system.
Yeah.
It kept believers tied to the church and its practices. There was no real way to escape it if you wanted to remain in a state of grace and eventually achieve salvation.
That sounds pretty demanding and maybe a little overwhelming for the average believer.
Yeah.
How did the everyday person in the Middle Ages typically think about penance? Was there, like, practical understanding different from this more formal sacramental view?
Yes. Dr. Green notes that for most people, their understanding of penance was, it was more simplified, focused on the actual things they were required to do. For them, doing penance meant carrying out the specific works they were given by the priest after confession.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't necessarily focused on the deeper theological framework of the sacrament itself.
It was more about the to-do list.
Exactly.
Okay, so what was the church's rationale for setting up and keeping this whole system of penance?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, from a modern perspective, it might sound, well, kind of burdensome.
Right. And Dr. Green points out that while it might seem, you know, negative or legalistic to us today, the church had what they considered to be good intentions.
Oh.
Their main goal was to, well, to keep believers actively engaged with the church, connected to their local community, and striving to remain in a state of grace. By requiring regular confession and, you know, the diligent performance of these penances, the church, they aimed to ensure this continuous link with their members and to guide their spiritual lives, hopefully preventing them from drifting away from the faith and, you know, falling back into sin.
Yeah.
In this view, the local priest was, well, he was trying to keep his flock spiritually healthy and safe within the church.
That's an interesting way to frame it. Like,
yeah,
a system designed for spiritual accountability and maintaining those community bonds.
Right.
So what kinds of works of penance were people typically assigned?
Well, Dr. Green gives us several examples.
Okay.
Fasting was a common one. Requiring people to abstain from food or certain foods for a specific time, it was a way to remind themselves of their sin and their subsequent absolution.
Okay.
Giving alms to the poor in the name of Christ, that was another frequent one. It was seen as an act of charity and a way of, well, of making amends for wrongdoing. Works of mercy, you know, like caring for the sick, visiting those in prison, feeding the hungry.
Right, right.
Those were common, too. Prayer was also a standard form of penance, often involving reciting specific prayers like the Lord's Prayer or the Hail Mary a certain number of times.
Yeah, okay.
And then there's this rather striking example of patient suffering.
Okay.
In the medieval world with all its, you know, disease, hardship, and no modern medicine, enduring illness and pain without, you know, without complaining too much, that was often presented as a form of penance.
Wow.
A way to participate in the suffering of Christ.
That really highlights the differences between their lived reality and ours.
Yeah.
And Dr. Green mentions one more form of penance, one that he says is really crucial to understand.
Yes, that's the practice of indulgences.
Right.
Dr. Green describes indulgences as, well, as a remission of a certain amount of that temporal punishment due in purgatory. He says he'll go into a lot more detail later, but it's key to recognize from the start that indulgences were really closely tied to this whole system of penance and the medieval understanding of sin and its consequences.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get into indulgences themselves, Dr. Green introduces one more theological concept that relates to penance. Works of supererogation. That's a mouthful. What exactly are those?
Okay, so to understand this concept of works of supererogation, Dr. Green really stresses that we need to immerse ourselves in the medieval worldview with its very literal belief in heaven, hell, and purgatory. So works of supererogation are basically defined as the excess merits, the extra good deeds, if you will, performed by, you know, exceptionally holy people like saints and martyrs.
Okay.
These are people who lived lives of like extraordinary virtue, often going above and beyond what was strictly required for their own salvation.
Right.
So these surplus good deeds, they were thought to be like accumulated and stored in a treasury of merit in heaven. Think of it almost like a spiritual bank account, I guess.
Okay, so like a spiritual bank account full of good deeds that went like beyond what was needed for their own salvation.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And the Virgin Mary, who is considered sinless by the church, is a prime example. Okay.
Because her sinless life and her numerous acts of piety, they generated this huge surplus of merit. Since she was believed to have ascended directly to heaven, right?
Right.
No need for purgatory. So all those extra good deeds, they had to have a purpose.
Yeah.
They were thought to be deposited in this heavenly treasury.
Yeah.
And the theological understanding was that priests, acting with the church's authority, they could draw on this vast reservoir of merits and apply them to, well, to ordinary people doing penance.
Oh, okay.
This application of this superabundant merit could help with their penance and potentially shorten their time in purgatory.
That's a fascinating idea.
Yeah, yeah.
So the exceptional holiness and good deeds of certain people could like be transferred or applied to help others on their spiritual journey and in their postmortem purification.
Exactly. Dr. Green acknowledges that the exact accounting of this system is, well, it's complicated.
And probably more symbolic than a literal, you know, spreadsheet in the sky. But he stresses that that in the medieval period, this was a real belief, and it had real consequences. If a priest said he was drawing on the merits of Mary or another saint to help someone, the faithful, they accepted that as a theological reality.
That's pretty powerful.
It is.
So this system of works of supererogation, it really supported the whole system of penance.
Yeah.
Because it provided a source of spiritual credit to offset the punishment for sins. It all fits together in this elaborate and really comprehensive theological system.
Exactly.
That's really remarkable. So just to recap what we've covered so far, we've talked about the nature of sin with its distinction between mortal and venial sin. We've explored the doctrine of purgatory as this place of purification after death. Mm. We've unpacked the sacrament and practice of penance as this way of atoning for sins. And we've touched on the intriguing concept of works of supererogation as this source of additional spiritual merit.
You got it. And as Dr. Green emphasizes throughout his lecture, these ideas, they weren't just abstract theological concepts, you know, debated in universities.
Right.
They shaped the everyday religious experience and worldview of people living in the Middle Ages. These ideas, they weren't isolated. They formed this cohesive and influential system that affected everything from individual behavior and, you know, devotional practices to people's deep anxieties about the afterlife and their eternal fate.
It's hard to overstate how powerful these beliefs were.
It really is.
So as we wrap up, it brings us to a really thought-provoking question for you, our listener. How did this intricate system of sin, punishment, and redemption, how did it shape not only the personal piety and spiritual lives of individuals in the Middle Ages, but also the power and authority and even the wealth of the church in medieval society? It seems like these beliefs, they had like far-reaching implications.
Absolutely.
That went way beyond just personal faith.
Yeah, and understanding this historical and theological context, it's essential if we want to really grasp those huge changes that happened during the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century.
Right.
And the development of, well, of Western Christianity as we know it today, you know. These were the very beliefs and practices that Martin Luther and the other reformers, they challenged so fiercely. And, well, that ultimately led to a radical reshaping of the Christian world.
This has been really illuminating and at times quite intricate deep dive into some really complex but important historical and theological ideas.
Right.
Thanks so much for guiding us through this. It's been fascinating to shed light on a world that, well, it's distant from us in time. It still echoes in so many ways.
It does.
And to you, our listener, we hope this exploration of medieval Catholic theology has given you some valuable insights into a pivotal period in Western history. We encourage you to really think about what aspects of this intricate system you found most striking and how understanding this past might help us understand our present a little better.
Yeah, it's such a rich and multifaceted history, and we hope this deep dive has offered you a clearer and more nuanced picture of the theological landscape of that era.
It has for me, for sure.